on to the last reading now in the new Ethnic Minorities Conference, to be preceded by a talk by Terry Gulley. I just want to announce for those of you who hadn't heard throughout this weekend that we've made a substitution in the program. We will not be showing Da Silva, Da Silva this afternoon, but instead a newer film that's just now beginning to make the rounds of film festivals, and we only have it on videotape, but it's very exciting. It's called Partition. The film Da Silva, Da Silva will be remaining here for a week so that we can show it next week at 1 o'clock. Here in this room. So if you came to see it or if you're interested and you've seen the Bandung productions until then, I strongly recommend Da Silva, Da Silva next Sunday at 1 o'clock here. And now once again, excuse me, Terry Kelly.
At the end of the last film, some of you were asking what can be done to help, and very interestingly enough, one of the group which we showed in the Dari Death film and the feminist group in India called Saheli, Woman Friend, who was helping them, have a member on this campus. And she's got newsletters of Saheli. So at the end of the proceedings, you can get all the information you want from her. And if people want to make contributions financially to help this group in the work they're doing, they will be gratefully received. This is the Saheli. I said a number of things this morning which really should have been made in this part of the discussion. So I'm not going to repeat what I said this morning, but will try rapidly to summarize what our project is and what we try to do. Those of us who are on the broad left and what our interventions in culture amount to. Those of you who were at Linton's concert, poetry reading rather, last night don't need any explanation as to what that entails and what the effect of that and the work of other poets does. The interesting thing is, and this is something which people have remarked on, that in a society which everyone acknowledges is in a sense decaying, and I talk now of Britain, and has been on the decline since the end of the British Empire, and its taking over of that old imperial role by the United States of America. And interestingly enough, one notices this, that there is a real decline even in the study of other parts of the world which used to be very pronounced in Britain. Asian studies, African studies, linked in to the role which Britain played in the world. All that is in decline now. Many of the third world studies departments are being closed down in universities and instead being replaced with, very instrumentally, Japanese studies. And the reason for that is not that they're interested in the culture of Japan, but they're very interested in Japanese industrial methods, especially factory discipline. So they need to train managers who can go to Japan and learn how to keep the workforce down. It doesn't always work, because an interesting thing happened the other day, that one of the slogans raised by the South Korean workers in their recent struggles was, if you want quiescent labor, go to Britain, don't come to South Korea. which was premature, because the British working class is very far from dead, leave alone passive, but nonetheless it's interesting the impressions and visions which people have of what has been happening in Britain under Thatcherism abroad. But of course all these departments of studying different parts of the world are now being transferred and developing and mushrooming and burgeoning in the United States, which is as it should be, because this is the prime imperial power today. And it needs to study those parts of the world which it is interested in oppressing and exploiting, because unless you understand what you are oppressing and exploiting, oppression and exploitation becomes a bit difficult. You need to know the substructure of the country, the social formation, etc., etc. Now, in this situation in Britain of a country which has lost an empire and has gained very little in return, and constantly dreams of the past becomes very important in British culture. And this past is constantly repeated in some shape or form, except where they still don't want to really encounter the past. And there you have a terrible vacuum. It's very, very interesting, I've always thought, that there is not one single powerful novel of the Second World War produced in Britain. The closest you get to it is a book which came out a few years ago by J.G. Ballard called The Empire of the Sun, which was a book written by a very talented English novelist about his life in China. And you see World War II taking place through the eyes of a young British boy in China during World War II. And it's always interested me that one reason for that, of course, is that ideologically this war was so important that there was no way they could move away and take a distance from what happened and begin to see it in terms of fiction, whereas other countries have produced interesting work, fictional work, on that particular period. Now, but despite that, the past lives on. It lives on in the attitudes and in the writings of many English novelists. It lives on in what is considered worthy of production, and they do it well. The past is reproduced fairly well. It's packaged beautifully and it's sold to television channels all over the world. And the BBC is, of course, a past master in this peculiar art form, which they do very well, whether it is the life of Henry VIII, whether it is the Virgin Queen, the reference being to Elizabeth I, whether it is the reproduction of Dickens. This is now reaching, there's recently they made a film of Little Dorrit, a two-part film, which has everything beautifully reproduced, to the costumes, etc. What they leave out is the subversive element in Dickens, because Little Dorrit isn't just a pretty story. There is in that novel stuff which, if used visually, can be fairly devastating. And that, of course, has been left out. And when they are attacked for doing it in that way, they say, well, you can't show everything, which is true. Of course you can't. So that then again becomes a question of choice. And one of the things which has been part of this nostalgia, and it's the nostalgia of a society which doesn't know what its future is going to be, which makes the past so important, that the question of reshaping British consciousness and attitudes and everything related to it becomes very important. And so one is constantly being faced with what attitudes to take to these things. And I don't know whether the series Jewel in the Crown was shown in the United States. It was. It was very pretty. And it was an interesting project. And some of the criticisms of it I didn't like, because it was a project of one guy called Paul Scott, who was not a very good novelist, but who did write about an interesting period in British history, which was the last days of the British Raj in India. And some of his comments on the British in India were not without interest, but these were then coated with saccharin and filmed very beautifully and made into a series which suddenly got the Indian tourist board very interested. That's one interesting result of that. The tourism to Kashmir increased phenomenally after the Jewel in the Crown was shown. So it shows that, you know, everything these days is related. Culture and the world economy become one in productions of this sort. And then you had Attenborough's film Gandhi, then you had A Passage to India. It added up, it multiplied, and I didn't like most of these things. to be perfectly frank, but one could see the role they played, and it wasn't totally negative. I have to say that what characterized these productions was that what they tended to do was they individualized oppression. So it's not that imperialism wasn't bad, but it was the case of one rotten apple in the barrel. And once that rotten apple was removed, this was the character of Ronald Merrick in The Jewel and the Crown, but the fact is that Merrick was a fairly typical lower echelon Englishman ruling India during the years of the Raj. There's nothing particularly new about that. Or in the Gandhi film, it was Gandhi as an individual. So you almost had him elevated to the status of a saint. And was there no one else? Leave aside on, you know, in other movements, was there no one else in the Congress Party of India? Yes, there were. And you were seeing these characters were simply shown in their relationship to Gandhi, by and large, which was sycophantic, as the film portrayed. In reality, it was a lot more complex. And the people to the left barely got a look in. So we confront all these problems when deciding what to do and what films to make. And we concentrated when we had to make a choice, when we found the money, on what cinema we were going to make. We made two feature films at Bandung. One was Da Silva Da Silva, which is the film version of a novella by the Guyanese writer Wilson Harris, who is a modernist par excellence and whose work is very difficult to understand. And to be perfectly frank, the only way I understood it was by reading it aloud like poetry, because the rhythm of his language is such that when you read it aloud, and I had to do this, I promise you, because before we made that film, I took all his novels, and they are over 12, on a summer holiday, thinking they would be entertaining light reading while I lay on the beach. And nothing could have been further removed from what they actually were, that you had... He makes it difficult for you to read him, does old Wilson. And I finally found myself reading this work aloud to myself, but then I did understand what he was driving, because through the rhythm of the language, you actually appreciated what he was doing. And it was a fantastical journey into the interior of his own mind, interior of Guyana, where he lived, in the rainforests. So we decided to make, because it was a real challenge to put his work on film, and so we decided to do it, to show what a modernist writer, classic modernist writer, produces. And he thought his work could never be filmed, and I'm happy to say that he was staggered when he saw that film, and he liked it a great deal. And so did many other people, even those who didn't totally comprehend it, saw the power of what this man was saying. And on India, we also had to make a choice. And the choice we made, you will see. It's not an easy film, let me warn you. So if you're, you know, used to a pacey, fast-moving thing, you will be disappointed. But it's a film about the partition of India. Now, the partition of India as it is portrayed, by and large, I don't think it's portrayed at all in the United States, because, you know, India is a big country far away, and one needn't bother too much about it. But by and large, the rest of the world is very involved with India, and the United States might become more immersed in it if they... is a chance that it might slip away from the capitalist world market, which there isn't at the moment. But in any case, in Britain, there is a great deal of interest in India because of the past connections of the British in India. And the episode which has been essentially covered up is the episode of partition and the events leading to the partition. And how it's portrayed, when it's portrayed at all, is lots of Indians killing each other. And it is true, as our film shows, that one of the supreme ironies of partition was the only people who could walk about freely were the British, just on the eve of their departure, whereas Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs were killing each other. And this partition has been underplayed because it was in the interest of all the sides in the affair to try and cover up what happened. But it has traumatized that subcontinent. and its legacy is still there in the killings that still go on. And over 2 million people were killed, mainly in northern India and eastern India. Again, I repeat, the south was unaffected. Not because there weren't many Muslims there. Kerala in the deep south of India has a large Muslim population, but there were no riots. Why? Because there was no movement of population. And if you think about it, what happened is horrific. What happened was that in the areas now constituting Pakistan, Hindus and Sikh families who had lived there since time immemorial were pushed out, and they had to go and find a home across the border in India. And lots of Muslims who had lived in Delhi since time immemorial moved here. Of course, lots of Muslims didn't move. They stayed on in India. But it was a fairly horrific event, which they don't come to terms with. And the other thing which is always said about this event by everyone, that it was inevitable, that it had to happen because Muslims and Hindus couldn't live together and all this sort of stuff. And the events which took place in 1946 on the eve of partition showed things totally to the contrary. You had a large naval mutiny in India, the most amazing naval mutiny in the whole history of the British Empire, when Indian sailors took over the navy. And these sailors were Hindus, Sikhs and Muslims. Took over the Indian Navy, set up a naval strike committee, ran up the red flag, and they panicked. The British panicked, and the leaders of the nationalist movement panicked, because here were people who were showing that what they were planning was wrong. Here were Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs working together and bringing the country to the brink of a general strike. There was a great deal of unrest, and the strike was called off, not by the British. They couldn't do anything. Admiral Godfrey, the British commander of the Navy, said, "We'll bomb you into the ground," and they fired a few salvos and said, "What are you going to bomb us with?" Because they literally they really saw visions of Potemkin and Aurora, these people, when they saw what was going on. Now, very few people in India know that. Many Indian students and campuses don't know that, because it is an episode which has been hidden from history, because it goes against the grain of what is being taught, leave alone in Britain, which never talks about this mutiny, the worst mutiny ever in the history of the British Empire. So when we talk about reshaping British consciousness, we believe in bringing those items which have been hidden, bringing them to the front. I'll stop there so you can see the film. Unfortunately, Linton and I have to go back today because we have work in London tomorrow. But I hope there will be a discussion of the film amongst yourselves, and Richard will write and tell me about it, because I genuinely would be very interested in hearing what people have to say. One last thing, the script, which was written largely by myself with some help from the director, Ken McMullen, is adapted or based on a short story by one of the great short story writers of India, Sadat Hasan Manto, who was a Muslim, moved from Bombay to Lahore, and he died at a very young age, 45. He drank himself to death, basically, because he was in a permanent state of depression after partition. It affected lots of people like that. And he wrote this short story, which is based on things which did happen, which is that in the lunatic asylums all over India, northern India, you had Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs. So what happens when you divide a country? What do you do with the lunatics? And Manto used this. He said in the Lahore lunatic asylum, they are Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh lunatics. And word goes out from the bureaucrats that the Hindu and Sikh lunatics have to be transferred from Lahore to asylums in India. So the bureaucrats go and tell them, and the lunatics say, "We don't want to go." So Manto uses this fact as an allegory and shows that sanity resides in the asylum, and it's the outside world which has gone mad. And it's such a powerful image that we got to work. We reconstructed the lunatic asylum of Lahore, which we had filmed and photographed clandestinely because they wouldn't let us do it. And we reconstructed it in the disused King George V Imperial Warehouse docks in Britain. And as we were building and constructing our set, we still saw the old signs of imperialism on the docks. Johannesburg, Durban,
Bombay.
Still marked out in chalk, so the actors in particular, you know, were entertained by this irony. So that's essentially the reason, because it was the 40th anniversary of partition last year, and we felt that some attempt had to be made to come to terms with it, and this was a start. It's by no means the last word, it's the first word to reopen a discussion which is now traumatizing lots of people. Thanks.